We're here at Attitude Adjustment, and we've done a swap on our guests. We now have Chris Pocock, who has been writing about the aerospace and defense business for nearly 30 years. He is a British citizen and a graduate of the University of Cambridge. Chris worked in the air cargo business for 10 years before becoming a full-time journalist in 1983. He subsequently edited two air cargo journals before becoming defense editor for Aviation International News. Aviation International News is all over the place. I am meeting more and more AIN journalists and ex-journalists in my comings and goings around the field here at AirVenture 2016. Chris, we are so happy to have you here. Now, one of the things I didn't say is that you've got a book here on site, and you are considered the expert for the U-2 spy plane. Tell us a little bit about your book and what fascinates you about this airplane.
Well, I'm considered the unofficial historian of the U-2, I suppose, and it's been my quest over 30 years nearly to try and tell that story, because when I first started looking at it in the late 80s, it was a little bit neglected and a little bit unloved as an aeroplane with a huge history, and I found that surprising. So, I've now written four books on the U-2, and the one that I have brought here this week is the latest one. I wrote a very big history of the U-2 when it was 50 years old, but that was in 2005, and now it's 60 years old, so I had to do a little book to supplement the big book.
Oh, that's wonderful.
The aeroplane's nickname is Dragon Lady, and that was the title of my first book.
Okay.
And the little one that brings the story right up to date for the last 10 years is called Dragon Lady Today.
Dragon Lady Today. That's the one I think I saw. Dragon Lady Today. You know, they still fly U-2 spy planes.
And that's, I was going to ask that. I mean, I'm curious, especially for people that may not really remember much about the 60s, that's when most of us old folks really came to know the U-2. But what is it about that airplane that makes it so useful today, 60 years after it was first flown?
Well, some basic characteristics of the airplane, its endurance and its high altitude are the two key things. It flies above 70,000 feet. So it's out of harm's way. It has a great look angle from that height. So over the years, new sensors have been added to it, very capable sensors added to a basic airframe. And so it can fly close to areas that you want to look at but don't want to overfly. And it can look into those places and bring back a lot of useful intelligence.
And the air crew, it's usually just one person, I believe, correct?
It's a single-place aeroplane. They have five, which are two cockpit trainers, but all the operational missions are flown by a single pilot.
And the crew, if the pilot were to be standing on the ramp, they look like they're in a spacesuit, essentially, don't they?
Essentially the same pressure suits as are worn by the astronauts. It's a full pressure suit, and it's needed because if the cockpit were to depressurize for any reason at 70,000 feet plus, you wouldn't survive for very long unless you had a pressure suit to inflate and protect you. Otherwise, your blood would boil.
Yeah, wow, that's kind of spooky, but that's what we saw when we watched the giant skydive that they did, the Red Bull people. I mean, they had to do that too.
Yes, indeed, and that was Felix Baumgarten, wasn't it? And he actually went to the facility at the U-2 base in California to get his pressure suit training.
You're an aviation journalist, and people always ask those kinds of questions of people like us, and they say things like, so what is it about this airplane that fascinates you so much that you could fill up this many books and not repeat yourself?
Well, I'm not actually a pilot. My major was in political history, but I went to university in a college that was mostly populated by engineers. So I have this kind of dual background of politics and engineering and aerospace. And the U-2, to me, was a fascinating combination of an airplane that was uniquely interesting from an aeronautical and a technical perspective, but with this very important political history as well.
Wow. And of course, again, going back in history, since we're talking about that, is that those of us in the United States may remember that first one that was brought down by a missile during the 60s. But if the airplane can fly at 70,000 feet and essentially avoid everything, was he down lower when he was hit?
No, you're talking about Gary Powers, and mm-hmm. you're talking about 1960 over the Soviet Union. And no, he was brought down.
I think I said Cuba. I meant.
No, you didn't, but you said 60s, and it was right at the beginning there.
It's because of the 60s. I can't remember everything.
I'll forgive you because a second U-2 was brought down over Cuba 2 years later during the Cuba Missile Crisis. But in both cases, those airplanes were brought down from above 70,000 feet, and the reason was that the Soviets had developed their second surface-to-air missile capable, unfortunately, of reaching 70,000 feet plus on a good day.
On a good day. So they had two good days. But I'm guessing that we have sensors that can tell if those missiles are around?
We do now, and we have had on the U-2 since 1962. But actually before that, there was no warning. But since 62, they've had a warning system which potentially enables them to alter course and evade the lethal kill zone of the missile. And since 1963, they've had active radiating countermeasures which have also protected those airplanes.
That's interesting. Now, there's something else I know, which is the CIA flies those airplanes. And there was a rumor going around that they'd actually flown them on and off a carrier.
Well, it's more than a rumor. It's a documented fact, and it's documented in my book, 50 Years of the U-2. The CIA basically developed the U-2. It's a story of how the CIA got into technical intelligence gathering for the first time in 1955-56 by being tasked to produce the U-2. And so they were the first operators of the airplane. The Air Force followed. The Air Force had been dubious about such a radical design, and they had other solutions to this problem of how to fly over denied territory behind the Iron Curtain, but their solutions weren't so radical and therefore not judged ultimately not so effective. So CIA sponsored the U-2 and they flew it, in fact, all the way from 55 through to 1974. But since 74, it has been purely an U.S. Air Force program.
Now, my understanding is the U.S. Air Force thought about replacing this airplane.
Oh, this airplane has been slated for replacement many times. In 1959, the CIA sponsored development of the Blackbird series, knowing full well that the U-2's time over protected territory, the Soviet Union with that new missile, that its time would be running out. So the Blackbird was designed, a superb aeroplane, but a huge development effort as a super fast and super high successor. And it indeed was that. But the U-2's unique characteristics of a long endurance and a sense of truck, if you like, less sexy and ambitious than the Blackbird, just made it a continuing to a viable airframe.
I'm trying to think of another example where an aircraft was designed for a purpose and was replaced eventually by a more high-performance aircraft that eventually was put in mothballs, and they're still going back and using the original one. That doesn't happen very often.
No, it doesn't. But let me make it clear that the U2s that fly today are not the U2s that were built in 1956.
Oh, good.
those first aeroplanes were retired quite a long time ago, and the aeroplanes that fly today were actually a scaled-up version, 20% larger, first built in 1968, a dozen of them built then, and then put back into production again in 1978. So the airplanes that fly today are somewhat younger, and there's still 27 of them flying. And actually, they could fly on for years because they fly in a benign high altitude environment in terms of stress on the airframes. So that's the fleet today. It's a relatively young fleet.
Wow.
Benign conditions. That's
no
really
birds,
interesting.
No other airplanes.
But they do have to get up and down. Yeah, you know, so there's a transitory area where they
doesn't take a long time. The thrust to weight ratio of the U2 is pretty impressive. I have actually flown in one, and you leave the runway at Beale, 10,000 foot runway, within 2,000 feet, and by the time you reach the other end of the runway, you're already at 10,000 feet.
Oh, that's crazy!
So you've actually flown in one? Wow.
Yeah, I was lucky enough to be the first foreign civilian to fly in the jet back in 95.
I think I'm going to need to go find your book on site. So you need to tell us where people can find your book and where they can find it online too, if they're out there in the internet listening.
Yes, indeed.
To us.
Well, online they can find it at my website, which is worldwideweb.dragonladytoday.com, but hopefully there'll be some copies left here. There's an aviation artist who I have collaborated with, Kristen Hill. She's done a number of U2 paintings, and she has a booth in Exhibit Hall A, booth 1158, where you can see her U2 paintings and buy prints of those, and my book should also be there.
Well, Chris Pocock, writer, journalist, and speaker, because you do speak about this as well. You've had the opportunity to do that here.
I've done a couple of talks here this week.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you so much for taking the time to visit with us on EAA Radio 96.5 FM and 1210 AM on your radio dial here at AirVenture 2016. I hope you have a great rest of the show.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming, Chris.